Investigative work.
What do you say?
They stumbled into leads.
Certainly it comes as no surprise to you that Coward was with the CIA.
No surprise at all.
They tripped over clues.
We'd like to see all the material requested by the White House.
All White House transactions are confidential.
This whole thing is a cover-up. It's right on our nose.
And piece by piece, they solve the greatest detective story in American history.
There is no way the White House can control the investigation.
I don't want to say anymore, okay?
Have you been threatened if you tell the truth?
Is there a cover-up?
Don't you understand what you're on to?
Mitchell knew?
Of course Mitchell knew.
Woodward! Bernstein! Get in here!
At times, it looked as if it might cost them their jobs.
You guys are about to write a story that says the former attorney general, the highest-ranking law enforcement officer in this country, is a crook.
Their reputations.
Why is the Post trying to do it? I don't know.
Perhaps even their lives.
Carl Bernstein.
Yeah,
and
Bernstein
Bob
and Woodward. Yeah, and to me, it was about their relationship. Like each other. Like that, to me, is what All the President's Men was. Now, if you want to liken that to truth, I don't know that you can, other than it's about the media. It's about hard work. But aside from that, I don't think there's much correlation because Dan was well known. These guys weren't.
Well, Robert Redford, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And I want to end with this question. Je suis Charlie, what took place in France, the whole idea of freedom of the press, freedom of speech, but also the backlash, the concern about Islamophobia and communities under siege, whether we're talking about in France or here at home, the Black Lives Matter movement. Your thoughts on where we are today?
Well, I mean, now we get down to democracy. I mean, I think it's very important to listen to other people's points of view, to be open, to be tolerant. I think what happened in Paris is tragic. I feel really responsibility because I spent a lot of time there. But I think it has to do with not acknowledging a segment of society. It sounds to me like, I don't know enough about it, but it seems that it had a lot to do with the Muslim population that was sort of cast aside. I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems like that was at the core of what was going on. Well, if it had been more inclusive, had that community been more included, given jobs, made feel a part of the social environment they were in, I'm not sure this would have happened. So I'm all for diversity and democratic behavior. That might not have happened.
Well, Robert Redford, I want to thank you very much for being
with us. Thank you. Stay on the air.
The Oscar-winning director, acclaimed actor Robert Redford, founder of the Sundance Film Festival, now in its 31st year here in Park City, Utah. That does it for the broadcast. If you'd like a copy of today's show or any of the Sundance broadcasts, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. On Friday, January 30th, that's tomorrow, I'll be speaking at Dolly's Bookstore on Main Street here in Park City at 1 p.m. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Caron, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Anna Ozbeck, and Sam Riddell. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. Special thanks to John Hamilton, Dennis Moynihan, Elizabeth Press, Brenda Murad, Chuck Skurich, Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, and David Prude. And special thanks to our team here at Park City Television, Stanton Jones, Kevin Rapp, Evan Heath, Aaron Springsteen, Craig Van Straylen, Corey Reno, and Yodivio Barrios. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The time is now 5:03. You are tuned into KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Winter Folk, the annual benefit concert hosted by Sisters of the Road, Saturday, January 31st, 7 o'clock p.m. to 10:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. This year's featured performer is auto harpist Brian Bowers. Other acts include Portland singer-songwriter Avery Hill, Flying Fish recording artist Don Lang, Kate Power and Steve Einhorn, and many more. Again, that's Winter Folk, a benefit concert for Sisters of the Road, Saturday, January 31st, 7 o'clock p.m. to 10:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater. 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the United States Senate has passed the controversial Keystone XL pipeline bill.
Union workers at the Port of Portland walk off the job after a breakdown in talks.
And a discrimination case against the local branch of Daimler Chrysler Corporation has been settled for $2.4 million.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 29th, 2015. I'm Sari Gametta.
And I'm Robert Barncord. The International Longshore and Warehouse Union walked out of the job yesterday afternoon at Port of Portland's Terminal 6. The ILWU's work stoppage yesterday is part of a long-running dispute between the union and the companies that own West Coast ports. Terminal 6 in the Port of Portland is owned by the International Container Terminal Services Incorporated. Short form of that is ICTSI. A conglomerate based in the Philippines. Since last spring, the union and port operators have tried to resolve issues of wages, pensions, as well as jurisdiction and work rules. The ILWU has also said that their operation at Terminal 6 is plagued by understaffing and equipment shortages. But discussions have stymied repeatedly, and the coalition of firms that operate many West Coast ports has called for a federal mediator in the discussion. KBOO reporter Eric Tagetoff reached ILWU's Local 8, which operates out of Terminal 6, but they declined to comment at this time. The ILWU has engaged in multiple slowdowns and stoppages over the past few months in order to resolve labor disputes.
A recent case by the Portland Bureau of Labor and Industries brought against Daimler Trucks North America on behalf of six Daimler employees was settled today at the amount of $2.4 million. The six employees came to the Bureau with allegations of racial discrimination and workplace harassment stretching back several years, and that they said went unaddressed by management at the company's North Portland plant. The company was largely cooperative with the Bureau's investigation, which began late last year, and has agreed to the monetary settlement as well as corrective and training measures to avoid future instances of harassment. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke with Charlie Burr from the Bureau of Labor and Industries earlier today.
This is Charlie Burr, Communications Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industry.
Yeah, today we just want to talk about the settlement that was reached with Daimler over the six minority employees that were experiencing harassment and racial discrimination at the workplace. Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk about the nature of that workplace discrimination, maybe kind of give some context and examples of why the case was brought to the Bureau in the first place.
Each case we get is different, but we investigated claims of harassment, intimidation, and in doing so, it quickly became apparent that there were systematic issues at place. So Brad Avakian, the state's labor commissioner, filed what is called a commissioner's complaint on behalf of the people of Oregon so we could address not just the individual complaints of intimidation, but the larger picture of Daimler's workforce. That's one of the reasons we're excited about the settlement today.
The case kind of looks at the systemic problem of the workplace, the Daimler workplace. And where does the settlement find, or where did the investigation find the problem to be rooted in? Was it in individual employees? Was it in workplace situations? Was it in the managers who neglected to deal with the problems when they became aware of them? Or
we had individual incidents of severe harassment and intimidation, but also at the structural level, just a breakdown of HR to really make meaningful corrective action. And that's one of the reasons that we have a strong compliance agreement in addition to the $2.5 million. So what that means is there'll be an independent hotline that any worker can call if he or she believes that they're being subject to unfair discrimination. BOLI will have access to that. We're also going to be conducting mandatory trainings. Daimler has asked us to train multiple managers so they can also do internal investigations and address and correct any future incidents that occur.
Now, Daimler kind of has a bit of a history of racial discrimination in the workplace, but they seem to be right in step with the Bureau in terms of wanting to fix these problems right now. Is that your impression as well, or are they resisting these new measures?
Daimler should be commended for fully cooperating with our investigation, and they have clearly indicated that they want to work with the Bureau to take corrective action and improve the workforce. And that's important. They're a significant employer. We think that this compliance agreement is going to make them continue to have them be an important part of the region's economy, but also in doing so, be a place where every worker at the North Portland facility is treated fairly and is not subjected to any kind of intimidation or discrimination.
So if this situation had kind of been ongoing, or if there's a history of discrimination, what barriers prevented workers at Daimler from reaching out to the Bureau before or feeling comfortable taking this route? And what barriers might exist for other employees at other companies in Portland?
It's always difficult to file a complaint like this. It's always difficult if you're an employee. You don't want to rock the boat. You don't want to put your paycheck at risk. And you look at the structural issues that you're up against, and it's difficult. We take each investigation very seriously. When the individual employees started filing with us, we looked at both those individual complaints, but also the pattern that had been going on for years and years up to the present day.
So are there any individual perpetrators at Daimler who are being held accountable, or is it purely kind of on the structure of the corporation that's taking all of the weight for this? I assume they're dealing with individuals in a disciplinary manner on their own terms, or are there any legal actions going against individuals?
Well, the strength of the settlement is that it is fair and just for the individual workers who were affected and harmed, who signed on to the settlement, but also structurally, it makes definite improvements for the workplace so Daimler could move forward and its workplace could move forward. In terms of the harassment and who was responsible for that, some of this was many years ago and the individuals were not working there, but if there are others who are still working there, that's going to be an internal Daimler decision on personnel.
Since this is the biggest settlement in the Bureau's history, would you say this is a vindication of the Bureau of Labor and Industry as a legitimate and effective means for discriminated employees to seek help?
Well, I think people would like to think that harassment of this type doesn't occur in this day and age, but the truth is that it does. So it's very difficult for people to bring complaints like this, but it's really important that people have a place to go. If people believe they're being treated unfairly and being subjected to discrimination at work, that's why we're here. They can file with our Civil Rights Division, and we'll investigate. And if we find wrongdoing, we will aggressively prosecute.
That was Charlie Bird with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and this is Ethan Martin at KBOO News.
The United States Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, has passed a bill, 62 to 36 votes, approving the Keystone XL pipeline. A similar bill was passed by the House of Representatives 3 weeks ago and awaits President Obama's final say on the matter. The president reserves ultimate control because the pipeline crosses an international border, and he has previously stated that he will veto the pipeline due to its negative environmental impact. Senate Democrats failed to add amendments ensuring that the pipeline would be built using American-made steel and that would ban the export of the oil from the United States. They were successful in getting the Senate to go on record stating that climate change was not a hoax and that the tar sand should be subject to a tax that helps pay for oil spill cleanup. Although the State Department has said the pipeline bill will have little or no impact on the environment, the massive amounts of fossil fuels made available by the tar sands will obviously only hasten the larger environmental dilemma of climate change. Republicans have touted the 42,000 temporary jobs projected by a review by the State Department, but out of all 42,000, only 3,900 are in construction, with the rest being in auxiliary sectors such as the service and food industries. The same review estimates that the pipeline would only produce 35 permanent jobs. President Obama has been delaying a decision on the pipeline for several years now, awaiting the release of reviews by the State Department and the decision from a court case in the state of Nebraska. Both of those have resolved in favor of the pipeline, but the president still awaits the release of several reviews from the EPA, the Department of the Interior, Homeland Security, from the Department of Defense, of Commerce, all of which are due by next Monday. The president is expected to decide on the issue as soon as February. He did promise 2 weeks ago to veto the Keystone XL pipeline bill if it passed the Senate, but the White House has not released a statement after the passage of the bill today.
Portland drivers may have been pleasantly surprised to see gas prices as low as $1.89 in the past few days, visible proof of the low price of oil that has been worrying the energy sector in the month of January. The price of oil per barrel has been hovering in the $40 range as the month draws to a close. Such prices weaken many of the arguments against the production and export of liquefied natural gas, or LNG. But that hasn't stopped both houses of Congress from moving forward with the legislation designed to expedite the federal permitting process for LNG export facilities. At a hearing held by the Senate Subcommittee on Energy and Natural Resources this morning, Paul Ciccio, the president of the Industrial Energy Consumers of America, spoke about why industrial interests are lobbying so hard for easier LNG project approvals.
When we come to this issue, we are looking not short term, we're looking long term, because the fact is there are uncertainties in the domestic market in terms of what price point can producers produce gas, that can impact investments. No one forecasted the price drop of crude oil. That was a surprise. That's impacting investment in oil and gas going forward. That will impact the supply. No one forecasted it. So we can't answer that question, what is the price point? But what we do know is from 2000 to 2008, the price of natural gas increased by over 200% in the United States. And then that was over a 20% increase per year. And over that time frame, we lost 44,000 manufacturing facilities. Now, those plants shut down were not entirely because of energy, but I have those types of companies, and they were a major part of the plant shutdowns.
A House bill that passed yesterday would give the Department of Energy 30 days to approve or deny a project once an independent environmental impact study was completed. The Senate bill would give the DOE 45 days. While the Obama administration doesn't think legislation is necessary, the DOE's Assistant Secretary for Fossil Energy, Christopher Smith, gave testimony at the hearing implying that the department could comply with at least Senate's longer time limit.
In terms of how the process currently operates, the way the department's operating is that there are two important things that a particular exporter needs in order to build a plant. They need to have authorization from FERC that shows that they can build the plant in a way that's safe, so they have to be able to build the plant. Then they also need authorization from the Department of Energy to actually export the molecules, and those two together create a project. Our process now says that we look at a particular an applicant after it's completed that FERC process to demonstrate that they can actually build the plant safely. In that aspect, we've moved very quickly. Essentially, as soon as these projects have come out of the queue, or out of the FERC process, we've moved very quickly. And in the case of one of the applicants, we acted the next day, you know, within 22 hours. So I think we've demonstrated that our intent certainly is to move quickly.
So is it fair to say that the Department of Energy would be able to comply with the deadline that's set in the bill?
That's my view. Yes.
Industry spokesmen took this as an admission that the Department of Energy could move much faster than it currently does to approve LNG projects. The subcommittee's chair, Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski, predicts that the bill will pass the subcommittee easily and be up for a floor vote within months.
Meanwhile, here in Oregon, two proposals have been moving sluggishly through the state permitting process, trying to build LNG export facilities on the Oregon coast. One project at Coos Bay is much farther along than the other, which had been proposed for a spit of land in Warrenton near Astoria by the Washington-based company Oregon LNG. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality held a meeting on Tuesday in Warrenton to answer questions from the public about their part in the permitting process, specifically 401 water quality certification. KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Dan Sears, conservation director at the environmental watchdog group Columbia River Keeper, for more on the story.
Can you tell me a little bit about what was discussed at those meetings and the Columbia River Keeper's role?
Sure. At those meetings, the Department of Environmental Quality for the state of Oregon was explaining its own process for reviewing whether or not these very large liquefied natural gas export terminals in Oregon should go forward. And they were specifically addressing the proposal in Warrenton to export over 1 billion cubic feet of natural gas a day. We have been opposing this project since its beginning way back in the middle of the last decade in 2005. And essentially, the state of Oregon would have to agree with Oregon LNG that there's no damage from dredging the Columbia River estuary. There's no damage from pumping all this carbon pollution into the environment in order to let the project go forward. And very emphatically, they received a message from over 100 people who attended that meeting in Warrenton that Oregon LNG is not welcome in the lower Columbia River and is vehemently opposed by people who live in the Warrenton area.
Recently, the Jordan Cove project, which is a similar export facility down in around Coos Bay, last month it was the subject of accusations by a whistleblower that there were considerable safety issues there that hadn't been addressed in the impact statement or any of the permitting process. Has there been any statements made about the Warrenton one, or is it just not that far along yet?
Yeah, the Warrenton one hasn't achieved the same level of progress as the Jordan Cove project, but to be clear, the people on the Columbia River absolutely oppose the proposal for an LNG export terminal in Coos Bay as well. We're standing united throughout the state of Oregon and Washington, the states of Oregon and Washington, to oppose both of these projects. They have very similar impacts, in fact. Both require a massive amount of dredging. Both involve disturbing contaminated sediments and soils, which is a major concern that you just raised that came up in the Jordan Cove project. And really where the rubber meets the road is the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon has to make a decision about whether or not these projects fit with our clean water protection laws. And so we're trying to send as emphatic a message as possible to Governor Kitzhaber and these state agencies to say no to LNG in Oregon.
And which state agencies are these? I guess what I mean is where does the buck stop with this?
It has a couple places to stop, which is good. The Department of State Lands has a direct decision-making role over both Oregon LNG and the Jordan Cove project. The Oregon DEQ has to decide whether clean water laws would be followed by both these projects. Those are two of the major agencies that have multiple decisions to make about each project. And so these two terminals and their associated pipelines need to get yeses in every box. They have to be approved for every permit. If we can get the state to agree with the hundreds of people they've been hearing from, the thousands of people they've heard from over the years, that these projects are bad for the state, and that they don't protect the water, they don't protect the salmon, they put people's safety at risk, then we win. Then the state can absolutely say no to these projects, and Oregon can put these LNG fiascos behind us.
They're trying to expedite the permitting process at the federal level. And would that have any impact on this project at all?
Yeah, these two projects in Oregon do need approvals from the federal government. To be really honest, we're relying on the state of Oregon to protect Oregonians because we don't have a lot of faith in the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to do its job and to really vet these projects. At the same time, the oil and gas industry is trying to take an incredibly biased federal process from FERC and make it even more biased in their favor. And really what they're trying to do is just ram these projects through as quickly as they can and put an enormous amount of pressure on states to make their own decision. But make no mistake, Governor Kitzhaber and the state of Oregon have all the authority they need to say no to LNG in Oregon. And we're learning more and more with each passing month about the enormous negative impacts these projects would have on the estuaries where they would be located, on the people who live near the pipelines that would be built to supply gas, and on the climate, where huge volumes of carbon pollution would be released from these projects.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the meeting that's happening tonight in Vernonia, what that is and where it stands in the timeline of the process of this LNG project?
Sure. Yeah. Tonight's meeting is very much like the meeting that was held in Warrenton earlier this week, where the Department of Environmental Quality and the Army Corps of Engineers are taking questions and having a discussion about how those agencies will make a decision on the Oregon LNG project in particular. And so it's a chance for people to raise their concerns, but mostly to ask questions and to understand whether the agencies will be doing their own independent reviews, which, going back to your earlier question about soil contamination that was discovered at the Jordan Cove site, you know, we're asking the state of Oregon to do its own work, its own review of the projects, and not to trust the companies or FERC in evaluating whether these projects are good for Oregon. So we hope for a good turnout tonight in Vernonia. There was certainly a big crowd in Warrenton, standing room only, and the overwhelming message came across from that group that Oregonians are opposed to liquefied natural gas exports.
All right. Dan Sears of Columbia Riverkeeper, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman.
According to Jennifer Purcell, head of Oregon's DEQ North Coast Regional Solutions team, official public hearings on the Warrenton project will be held later in the year 2015 once draft versions of all of Oregon LNG's permit applications are available for public review, and KBOO Radio will continue to follow this story throughout the year.
A coalition of Native nations along the Columbia River are coming together to research the possibility of restoring the salmon population in the river. 75 years ago, the last salmon swam the upper Columbia River. The salmon were then blocked by the Grand Coulee and the Chief Joseph Dams. Both of these dams were built without fish passageways. Loss of the Salmon Run damaged the spiritual and cultural identity of the Native people of the area by destroying their 10,000-year-old fishing tradition. The Northwest tribes of Washington and Idaho have proposed researching whether salmon could survive at all in the greatly changed habitat. Forest growth, water quality, and the entire food chain have been affected by the absence of salmon in the Columbia River. The tribes will also research the process and cost of engineering and installing passageways for fish in these dams. They will collect comments on their proposal for 30 days and then make a final plan.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Medea Benjamin of Code Pink about today's protest against Henry Kissinger at the Senate Armed Services Committee. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, it'll be Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather, is very likely going to be sunny and clear with a high of around 52, a low of around 37, pretty much average. Today in history, in 1863, in the Bear River Massacre, a detachment of California volunteers killed 246 men, women, and children of the Shoshone tribe. And on this day in 2009, Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich was removed from office for attempting to sell the appointment to President Barack Obama's vacated Senate seat to the highest bidder. The quote for today is from Russian writer Anton Chekhov, who was born on this day in the year 1860. It is easier to ask from the poor than from the rich.
It's 5:30, time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
My father was an early member of a group now known disparagingly as Ultra Lawn People. High, as everyone called him, was dedicated body and soul to the Sisyphean task of trying to maintain a lawn full of lush St. Augustine grass in hot, dry Texas. He planted, watered, fertilized, watered, mowed, watered, fought bugs and brown patch, watered, replanted, watered, ad nauseum. Some years he won. In other years, nature rolled him. High departed his lawn and this earth well before climate change turned Texas from merely hot and dry into scorched and parched. I know he would have denied it at first, but I think even he would have finally given in to today's new reality. In our drought-ravaged Southwest, the lush lawn is dead, literally and ethically. From Texas to Southern California, city after city is adapting to nature. They're policing neighborhoods to impose big fines on excessive lawn watering, paying homeowners and businesses to rip out grass and replace it with desertscapes, and even outlawing grass yards in new developments. And it's working. A pioneering 2003 turf removal rebate program in Las Vegas, for example, has now pulled 165 million feet of thirsty lawn grass out of the area, saved more than 9 billion gallons of water, and cut water use by a third, even as the population has mushroomed. This is Jim Hightower saying, such an effort would have been treated as heresy only a decade ago, but now it's simply considered the right thing to do. This is not merely an environmental adjustment, but a fundamental ethical shift, especially among younger people. The idea that green lawns are exercises in ecological narcissism has taken root in this arid and politically conservative region, demonstrating that conservatism really can be about conserving.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
A new leaked document shows that U.S. government lawyers advised Guantanamo authorities that force-feeding is never acceptable under medical ethical standards. The internal memo was issued by government lawyers at the same time as dozens of military nurses were being sent to the prison to force-feed detainees. An internal memo was obtained by Vice News through FOIA and is dated June 21, 2013, which was at the height of the prison's mass hunger strike. The memo states that international law and certain medical ethical standards hold that the forced feeding of a mentally competent person capable of making an informed decision is never acceptable. This previously secret legal advice proves that the Department of Defense knew it was placing military nurses and doctors at risk of professional sanction by conscripting them into an unethical medical procedure. The advice appears to have been drafted in the same period that dozens of fresh military medics were rushed to Guantanamo in response to the prison's escalating hunger strike. At that time, prisoners reported that the new personnel exhibited considerable stress because they were participating, for the first time in their careers, in a forced medical procedure. It's unclear whether Guantanamo ever permits medical staff who have ethical qualms about force feeding to not participate. One former head of nursing at the prison, Commander Jane French, had previously indicated that medical personnel who objected to force feeding would be excused without sanction. Yet the Department of Defense is currently weighing disciplinary proceedings against one military nurse who refused to participate in force feeding on ethical grounds.
The U.S. government has admitted that an Australian man who was imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay for over 10 years is innocent of the terrorism charges he was convicted of. Australian David Hicks was sent to the U.S. prison camp on Cuba in 2001. In 2007, he pleaded guilty to the charge of, quote-unquote, providing material support for terrorism. But Mr. Hicks and his lawyers have insisted that the guilty plea was made under duress and that he was innocent of all the allegations leveled at him. While in U.S. military custody, he was allegedly beaten and threatened with deadly violence. Now, his lawyer has reported that the U.S. military has now acknowledged that Hicks is innocent and will make that acknowledgement publicly at an upcoming court hearing. As a result, the Court of Military Commission Review in Washington could reverse his conviction. Mr. Hicks, who is now 38 and lives in Australia, converted to Islam in 1999 at the age of 24 and traveled to Afghanistan to study. The U.S. claims that camps where Hicks spent time in Afghanistan were operated by Al-Qaeda. But Mr. Hicks insisted he never saw evidence of terror-related activities. He later stopped following the Muslim faith. He was captured by U.S. forces in the chaotic aftermath of the West's invasion of Afghanistan and was among the first group of prisoners to be sent to Guantanamo Bay. In 2007, he signed a plea deal in which he agreed he would never appeal his conviction, but which allowed him to return to Australia and complete 9 months in jail.
The Supreme Court of the United States decided yesterday to block the execution of three inmates on death row in Oklahoma. The executions were overruled because of concern over the sedative midazolam, which caused Clayton Lockett to writhe in pain for nearly an hour during an execution in Oklahoma last April. The sedative could violate a constitutional ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Last week, inmate Charles Warner was executed with the sedative before the Supreme Court could delay his execution. The Supreme Court is scheduled to hear arguments on the case of execution by the controversial sedative on April 29th and to make a decision before the month of July this year.
Oregon state officials have announced that gray wolves are making a significant recovery in Oregon. The Department of Fish and Wildlife have announced that the state is ready to move to phase two of the wolf recovery plan created several years ago. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Robert Clavins of the conservation group Oregon Wild about what this means for Oregon.
Robert, can you tell us about the new announcement by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife that they're moving to phase two of Oregon's wolf management plan? What does that actually mean?
Yeah, well, you know, it's always good to celebrate positive news, and there is something really positive in what we heard yesterday, and that is that Oregon's wolf population, though where it's still fragile and numbering somewhere in the dozens, is growing, and pups are surviving. We've got pups surviving in Western Oregon for the first time in generations. We have now seven confirmed breeding pairs of wolves in the state, and those are all really important milestones for wolf recovery. It wasn't that long ago we didn't have wolves in the state at all. Let's learn from our experience, and let's look at what other states have learned as well, and double down on the things that are working, which I think has been a effort to focus on conservation, education, preventing conflict through non-lethal means rather than simply going back to the old way, the easy way of picking up a gun and shooting an animal that some people think is inconvenient.
And when you talk about preventing conflict through non-lethal means, are you talking about protecting livestock from wolves by putting up fences and that kind of thing?
Yeah, there are a lot of different things that we can do to prevent conflict. The reality is that as long as wolves have a stable prey base and we're not shooting them, they can do really, really well. We almost always end up talking about conflict when it comes to wolves because for some they are a very polarizing animal. But it's worth noting, I think, that you know most Oregonians value wolf recovery. They want to see wolf recovery take hold, and overwhelmingly are in support of seeing healthy, abundant populations of native wildlife, of which wolves are a part. But there is truth to the fact that to a certain extent wolves can cause problems. We should put those numbers in context when it comes to the livestock industry. Talking just about cows, Oregon is home to 1.3 million cows. The last year for which we have statistics, over 55,000 were died before they made it to the slaughterhouse from weather, disease, domestic dogs, human thieves, poisoning, birthing problems. Only five were lost to wolves. That said, I think it's important to recognize to the extent that there are some that we want to reduce that number to zero if we can. And that might be a difficult thing to do, but in other states where they're trying things like killing wolves, we've actually seen those numbers go up. And some of the ways that you can protect livestock, it can be fencing. It can be simply more human presence rather than just turning your cows loose for months at a time and not checking on them, having a greater human presence. It can be domestic livestock guardian dogs. There's a number of things that can be done, and they require, you know, there's not a one size fits all. Different places, different things will work, and they need to be. There are some people who will, you know, sort of poo-poo the idea that this stuff works, but it's been demonstrated in a number of places that when applied earnestly and rigorously and appropriately, things can work to really reduce conflict.
And what are the benefits of having wolves in the ecosystem? And does it help with keeping down numbers? I know in the East Coast they have talked about the lack of predators causing increases in deer herds that are encroaching into human areas. The wolf population increasing help with keeping, say, deer numbers down?
You know, there are impacts that wolves have. They're an apex predator. They're a keystone species, so they have a disproportionate impact on the landscape compared to a lot of other animals there. And we've seen that in places where when you take away the large predators, their prey numbers get out of control. And we saw that in places like Yellowstone, where the elk herd was way over management objectives. We see that actually even out here in Wallowa County, where there have been times where people have been paid to haze elk away from agricultural fields and agricultural operations. And things are certainly complicated, so it's not necessarily, you know, just add wolves and everything gets better. But again, there is sort of a basic principle that if the landscape evolved for eons with wolves as part of that system, when you take that away, you have an ecosystem and a landscape that's lesser than it was before. You know, keeping all those pieces is incredibly important. And wolves play a role that is, you know, we're finding is irreplaceable on the landscape. We can try to replicate it with hunting and with other management, but at the end of the day, nature, you know, did a pretty good job figuring things out. Trying to let nature take its course in some cases is often a good first step.
Well, I do want to thank you so much for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Clavins. He's with Oregon Wild, talking about the announcement that Oregon has now reached a threshold of having a number of wolves living in the wild here in the state and is moving on to phase two of the wolf management plan here in Oregon. More information can be found on their website, which is OregonWild.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The United States Environmental Protection Agency, the government body tasked with protecting American citizens from environmental health hazards, has recently decided to increase the allowable amount of toxic herbicides sprayed on GMO crops grown here in the United States. Most commonly used herbicides, such as Roundup, contain glyphosate, a chemical which suppresses weed growth. While glyphosate has not been definitively linked to health defects yet, many herbicides utilize a chemical known as 2,4-D, a component of Agent Orange. Repeated exposure to this chemical has been linked to Parkinson's disease, to birth defects, and to cancer. With the EPA's increase of allowable herbicide concentration on crops here in the United States, we can expect a correlating increase in the amount of glyphosate and 2,4-D to which the American public will be exposed.
Australian uranium mining company Paladin Energy has been accused of discharging uranium-contaminated sludge into Lake Malawi, Africa's third largest freshwater lake. The lake is a major source of water and fishing for 1.7 million people in the bordering countries of Malawi, Mozambique, and Tanzania. Drinking the contaminated water can cause cancer and damage to the kidney. According to the Coordination Union for Rehabilitation of the Environment, Lake Malawi provides about 20% of the population of Malawi's protein requirements. The Australian mining company has been dogged by controversy since they began operation in 2007 in Malawi, the world's 13th poorest country. When Paladin Energy originally built their uranium mine near the lake, their standards were so low that an environmental engineering professor in Melbourne believes that the company would not have gotten approval to operate in Australia. The company has denied responsibility for contaminating the lake.
A small group of roughly 100 women gathered in downtown Cairo today to protest the deaths of 25 activists killed by police last Saturday. This is the fourth anniversary of the 2011 Tahrir Square uprising. Last Saturday, Egyptian police opened fire on the activists who had peacefully gathered, making them the latest victims of harsh military crackdowns on dissent, which have claimed the lives of roughly 1,400 people since President al-Sisi overthrew democratically elected Mohamed Morsi in a military coup. The women protesters today held up pictures of those killed last Saturday and chanted, "Down with military rule," and "The Interior Ministry are thugs," while a police line watched from the other side of the street. Among those shot dead last Saturday was 32-year-old mother and poet Shaima Sabah, whose widely publicized death helped galvanize today's protest.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The American Postal Workers Union is on a crusade to both preserve postal services and to save good middle-class jobs in the process. APWU President Mark Demenstein says the campaign for postal banking would help the Postal Service while providing affordable basic banking.